Hello, everybody. This is Mark Ciaccardini, founder and editor of Go See Talk. Thank you once again for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Oh, man, beep, boop, boop. We've got one hell of a guest today, Jake Kaufman. He got his degree in shovelry. He is an expert in the digital wizardry of soundtracks. Aside from Yoji Kondo, the best video game music guy in the world. We're lucky to have him on the show. So without further ado and a lot of rambling, please welcome to the stage, Jake Kaufman. How's things in your world, buddy?
Hey. I don't know about all that. I'm definitely a Koji Kondo fan, but he's up there in my pantheon. But yeah, I consider myself more of a fan than a composer at this point. There's okay. so many amazing people to listen to. And so it's weird to consider myself to be one of them at all. So it's great to talk to you and talk a little shop.
Well, please let's open this shop. Let's say we're open for business. Let's spend 22 hours talking about everything from synthesizers to grungy effects to Shovel Knight and DuckTales. I think that's really the meat and the potatoes of today is going to be Shovel Sweet. Knight and DuckTales. But before we get into that, why don't we go back to digital soundboard, something that really kind of grabbed your interest at a young age, and also tell us, what was the first video game that you remember playing?
All right. Bear with me for a minute. I'm just still kind of warming up, accessing my memory banks here. It'll take a sec before I get into full ranting mode.
Blow on the cartridge.
Yeah, I gotta just, well, if you wiggle it with a finger, that it'll reseat the contact and it works well. So I'm going like that. All right. So the first, I guess, exposure to video games I had was the Magnavox Odyssey 2.
Ooh.
Or Odyssey Squared, I guess some people might call it. It's got the little superscript 2 on there. But it was a pre-NES, roughly equivalent to the Atari 2600 or the Intellivision, ancient game console that my grandparents had given to me as a hand-me-down, but they worked it up as being this whole arcade setup. They're like, you want an arcade at home? You can have a whole video game arcade. And I was like, I was so excited because I'd heard people talking about Nintendo. And I was like, this is just like a Nintendo. It's going to be just as good. It wasn't just as good as the Nintendo. So I coveted one immediately after playing. They had a Pac-Man ripoff called Casey Munchkin. Had very rudimentary graphics and even more rudimentary sound. But already I was amazed by the blips and the bleeps. They sounded like nothing else that I'd ever heard before, other than maybe the ice cream truck or, you know, like one of those like spaceship rides in the grocery store that the kids, you know, that sit on. And so I was like, what is this toy doing in my living room? And like, there's gotta be some good music on this. There's gotta be some good stuff happening. And so as soon as I got a Nintendo, it was on, I was obsessed. The music that people wrote for example, Zelda and Zelda 2, different composers, but both quite formative in my my early composing obsession. I'd say the first Nintendo game I got was Zelda 2, and that my mom would make me play her the music on the piano. She would encourage me every day to play this game music that was coming from this toy in the living room. And I took it seriously as a result from the start. So it's never been a novelty or less than in any way to me. It's always been serious music that just happened to be created by a very simple synthesizer instead of, you know, an orchestra.
Explain that a little further. Were you like DJing video game music, or did your mom actually want you to sort of extrapolate it to a piano? Is she a music teacher? How'd that work?
Oh yeah, it's easy for me to take that for granted, that people wouldn't know what I meant by that. But my family has been intensely musical probably since the 1800s. We're just a long line of musos and creative people. My dad is a bluegrass banjo picker and guitar shredder. He plays finger style stuff. My mom was a guitarist and a piano player and a clarinetist all of my grandparents play musical instruments in some capacity. It was just a normal thing growing up that that I would be in front of the piano. I mean, from age zero onward, they put, as soon as I could sit upright, they sat me in front of the piano. It became my timeout when I would misbehave. You're granted, you can't do anything, but you can play piano. You could also read science books. So I had a very limited number of things I could do at any given time. I was always grounded for something. So I got a lot of time with the keyboard, and I just naturally evolved with it. I never took lessons. I took lessons for about 2 weeks once and realized it was not for me. I would just end up disappointing the teacher because half the time I wasn't listening and the other half of the time I wasn't practicing, or I'd practice what I wanted instead of what they wanted me to practice. But most of my musical education was therefore because my parents gave me access to instruments. They put things in front of me and said, hey, you want to play this? It's here. And so my mom she'd just say, hey, I like the music in Zelda too. Why don't you try to play some of it? And I would play it by ear. And I mean, they weren't great arrangements at the time. Just basic two-handed stuff. But I was trying to figure out how the harmonies worked, and how to, you know, learn all the melodies and the bass lines. And so that taught me the first bits of how songs are constructed. Trying to figure out game music, basically, and other stuff like pop music. I was a huge fan of Danny Elfman when I was a kid, and I had his tapes and then a CD of Music for a Darkened Theater, which is his magnum opus, so this is his greatest hits. And I would listen to those tracks and try to figure out how they were constructed. I took all kinds of inspiration from, you know, I would make my own songs that sounded Elfman-esque, just to amuse people. You know, anytime there was like a talent show or a school play or anything where I could be the impresario, I would jump in with a keyboard and be their musical backing, either composing my own stuff or just playing, you know, whatever songs were in the musical. So yeah, I was just kind of as raised to be a musical entity. And they were convinced that I was going to get into science or math or something like that. I was in all kinds of advanced classes for STEM stuff, but I failed out of all of those, and music was the only thing I was consistently passionate about. You know, I'd like algebra for a couple of months, and then I'd completely lose interest in it. And the whole time I was playing piano, and making little arrangements on portable keyboards, like, you know, the little Yamaha and Casio keyboards they have, and, you know, you can get them at Best Buy or, you know, any music store, the cheap ones. Sometimes they have a built-in recorder, and I was the guy that actually used those things. I would make my own songs and rhythms and custom arrangements in those little keyboards. And they had no way to record the output to a disc or anything like that, so you had to hook up a cassette tape recorder and hope to get it that way. So there was a lot of, it was very ephemeral. There were a lot of temporary things that I worked on that I knew I'd never see again, but it was just fun working on machines like that, getting to know all the buttons and stuff.
Well, that's cool. I didn't know that they had a recording capability, because yes, I've had, I don't come from a musical family, and I'm actually quite glad that you didn't go down a bluegrass route, because I think we wouldn't be talking about this awesome stuff if you had followed what your dad did. But all that said, I had a number of small little cheapies, and if aside from the sort of the preset tempos and things like that, I just never thought that there would be a way to sort of, you know, produce and capture your own stuff. That's cool that you got to try that, even though, like you said, it was ephemeral and it went away.
Yeah, they're not in every keyboard. You know, the some of the more basic ones, they don't have any kind of recording feature. But yeah, any of those mid-range keyboards have some kind of custom rhythm or, you know, song mode you can record a chord progression in. So that was my sort of gateway into computer audio. It was my first taste of programming music as opposed to only performing it. And I don't know, I'd like to think that I at least learned from my dad how to make somewhat compellingly realistic guitar parts on in MIDI because I heard him playing so much that it burnt into my head. And now I kind of like, I feel that country vibe in me, even if I don't write stuff that sounds like that all the time. If I need to do a bluegrass piece, like, I think I can do a fairly authentic interpretation of it. Definitely opened my mind to a lot of stuff I never would have considered otherwise.
Well, when you were playing with the Magnavox and then graduated to the NES, did you ever get maybe 5 minutes into a game and then just go, the music's not grabbing you, and so you just turn it off, or you go, this sucks, I'm just, you know, whatever. Even if it was the most amazing game ever, just if it didn't grab you, did you just give up on it?
The only time, I'm not particularly fond of disparaging particular composers, but there were a couple of games where I turned them on and I remember thinking, oh no, my cartridge is defective. What happened? Why is the music all? And then later realizing that's what it's supposed to sound like. And so I had personal experience with this phenomenon later in my career, as a couple of games that I shipped broken somehow. Like the music was missing half of the channels, or some song wouldn't play, or like the drums were all piano instead of drums. And so I felt a little bit of, it was kind of a comeuppance a little bit. I was like, oh, well, it goes around, comes around. I was laughing at these guys. Maybe that is what happened, and it broke days before they shipped the game. But probably it was just that the music was terrible. But I didn't stop playing the game. I just thought, wow, this is unfortunate. 'Cause I'm a kid. I only maybe get to choose one game every 4 months or so. So I'm going to make the most of this one. So I try to like see it as a sunk cost and soldier through playing the game, even if the music was terrible. On the other hand, there were a lot of really terrible games that had incredible music. And again, I don't want to name names, but we all have played those that are, it's like, why is the soundtrack so much better than anything else in the game? And then a little bit further on in my career, people started saying that about certain games that I had worked on. And I felt really crappy because I was like, I don't want to diminish the hard work of all the other people that worked on this, the artists and the programmers and everything like that. So I was just like, don't even tell me that. It's not a compliment for me at this point, because at that point I was on a team instead of being, you know, just a lone composer out there.
Okay, I see.
So I took it personally when they didn't like the game that I worked on, even if I didn't disagree in certain cases, you know, that the game had been rushed or something like that. I would never like posture myself as being the saving grace of a video game. You know, I don't want to be the only thing that people like about it.
Well, so, you know,
luckily that hasn't happened too often.
Well, I feel that since I'm not a composer and I don't have any stakes in the game, I'll go ahead and say a couple that were Back to the Future was kind of a terrible game, and the music was just so droning. But the thing is, I talked to Paul Leonard Morgan, a composer who does video games and mm-hmm. he did Dread. And I said, you know, Paul, what in your mind, what do you think makes a video game soundtrack so endearing? Why do people go crazy? I said, is it the tempo? Is it really good, you know, hooks? And he goes, no, because you play it for 40-50 hours. And so, you know, I remember playing probably hundreds of hours of Batman and DuckTales and mm-hmm. And you know, Hook and things like that. But then again, those, you know, those video games only had a finite gameplay, whereas now you could spend 40 hours just to get through it once. So yep. All that said, I think that it's good or bad. There are so many wonderful things about, you know, sitting down and getting invested in the game and how the music really just takes you into that world. So
yeah, the repetition factor is definitely a factor there. It's yeah, these songs are like 30 to 45 seconds long, and you hear them for many, many hours on end. In the particular case of Back to the Future, I have an interesting theory/story with that one. Well, I know why it sounds like that, basically. Okay. If you listen to the music, this is Back to the Future 2 and 3 for Nintendo.
Oh, I don't have much experience with that one. I have the first one.
Because... You know what that is?
It sound like the video game.
That is actually the power of love sped up by like double at least. You know, the original Power of Love song.
Mind-blowing.
We discovered this. A couple of friends were experimenting with like NSF's Nintendo Sound Format, and they slowed it down and discovered that it's actually the riff of... So my thinking is they got like a MIDI file of the Power of Love and threw it in the game, and then they realized, oh crap, we don't have any way to control the tempo because it's 60 hertz and I can only play... It's complicated technical reasons. They can only play it at a certain speed, and they just went with it. Nobody checked it. That was, an example of breaking the music before the game ships. And so what an unfortunate thing to have happen, you know, when you put in the hard work of transcribing a song like that, just to have it played at turbo speed. So it's like, that kind of thing is like, it's my constant nemesis and worry that I'll deliver the stuff and it won't get put in correctly. As a result, that's why I try to become friends with all the programmers. They take care of me these days, and it's great.
I see. I like that. Scratch my back, I scratch your back. And then that way, even if there are bees and guys with panes of glass on a street, at least the music will sound good, even though the game has nothing to do with the movie. That's great.
We got a system at the very least. Yeah. But I don't know. Yeah. These days it feels like it's a bit more safe technically. Like people have everybody's best interests in mind. Like the egos are sort of out of the picture, at least in my personal workscape. So they're, you know, everybody's working together collaboratively on a thing, and we have a lot of pairs of ears on any given song. So if there's anything wrong with it, I'll probably know before a disastrous release like that.
Well, man, I tell you, I could, not that I want to, but I could end the interview with just having the Power Love thing. That's wow. That's mind blowing. But what I do with this website is a hobby. So I'm in architecture. And so I work on hotels and resorts. But at the end of the day, you know, that gets turned over to the consumer, somebody who, you know, the developer and the owner, and then a consumer who uses the hotel. And I would assume that similarly, you work on something that's a video game, and then it goes to, you know, people out there to go take home and play for their consoles. But the thing I was curious about is, you know, Nintendo made this stuff, Sega made this stuff, all these things, all these decisions are made in-house. So when it comes to video games, do you have outside developers and producers who have a say on this, or are video games kept internally to the point where it's turned out to the audience?
Well, besides getting the development kit hardware, like Nintendo leaves us alone other than standards. If we need to make sure that the game like looks a certain way on the screen, doesn't go outside of certain dimensions so that it doesn't look weird on TVs. There are a bunch of like technical things that are requirements to have your stuff released on a first party platform, which is what you would call a Nintendo or a, you know, PlayStation or something like that. Each one of those companies has their own things that you have to do to ensure that consumers get like a standardized experience anytime they play a game on that console. So we have to go through a whole bunch of checks and procedures and forms that we have to fill out. And they're just things you can't do technically that are verboten. And you have to make sure that you're staying within the standards. But other than that, it's whatever you want to do. As long as the thing runs and displays pixels and has some kind of sound. I think sound is probably a requirement for any of these things. But yeah, past that, they don't really exert a whole bunch of control over the creative process. And that's mostly on the developer. That all goes out the window when you're doing like Marvel or, you know, a licensed thing like that. The publisher will be scrutinizing everything you put in the game. But for something like Shovel Knight, that's the appeal of indie game programming, is that you don't really have anybody over you telling you what to do. And that's super freeing. It's a great feeling. It's also a little scary because you have to figure out how to do your own everything, marketing, and you know, you don't have the muscle of these big companies behind you, unless you're featured on, you know, Nintendo Direct or something like that. You know, they'll help you out, but it really is on the developer to grow into their tools and learn how to do everything. So that's one of the reasons I love working with indies, is that whatever the director says, it's law, you know. We don't have to wait for approval on things. If the team thinks something is a good idea, then we can do it, and that's it. So I have a lot more editorial freedom, and I feel like I'm less on trial when I work with indie clients, or with my own employer, in this case Yacht Club. They just let me do what I think is right, and it usually works out well. Yeah, I don't does that answer your
I think it totally does, and I think you were able to dial into what I was not able to put together, because the thing that I just find funny is that, the more opinions you have, the more complicated the process can get when, mm-hmm. If you think back to that great behind the scenes footage of John Williams and Steven Spielberg working on the score to E.T., where it's, they're at a piano. Boom, I like it. And you don't have to bring in all these people who have to, just complicate the matters. And mm-hmm. anyway, so I think that's very helpful.
Especially when I'm working with Sean or Alec at Yacht Club on Shovel Knight or Mina the Hollower, respectively. That's our current project. It feels like a direct collaboration, and it's like a meeting of the minds. And that's the magic really happens in that moment. And if everybody else in the company hates what I've done, I'm probably going to revise it. It's not like I'm just going to say, this is what you get and that's that. It's a process to find consensus, but I don't know. You can cut a lot of that out preemptively by finding people to work with who are on your wavelength. So there isn't that much conflict to begin with. It's great. Hey, I really love working with creative technical teams like that.
Why don't we dive into Shovel Knight? Because I'm going to go in a disclaimer. I have not played a single second of Shovel Knight. However, you've got a lot of traction with the series. Mm-hmm. So much so that I love the Pocket Dungeon. And I haven't played that either. But they're also two completely different games. Mm-hmm. But the score has some similarities. So why don't we just go back to the beginning? How did you get involved? What were some of the first discussions you had trying to bring this world a soundscape?
For the original Shovel Knight, you mean?
Yeah. And then we'll get to Pocket Dungeon.
Well, I would say the moment they told me about the idea, I was immediately sold. Yacht Club had gone off on their own. We had all worked together at WayForward prior to that. And so bunch of them splintered off, formed their own company because they wanted to be indie, and had to come up with a good first project that would gain traction. And so they were just putting stuff on index cards and, why don't we try this concept? Oh, how about this? It's a knight with a shovel instead of a sword. And everyone's like, oh, that's dumb. Why? We can't nobody would like that. Okay, we're going to do it. And then they did it. And so the moment they told me about it, I was immediately hooked. Because it sounded like such a ridiculous idea that it couldn't help but be amazing. Like, anything that's obviously silly, but portrays itself in a deadpan, hyper-serious kind of way, that's right up my alley. So as soon as I realized I could basically joke around but be completely serious musically, it just took off in my head. And I started making, ideas for different themes. A fun thing that happens in development, and I mean fun thing in scare quotes, is that when the composer gives the client the first couple of tracks for a project, that's all they hear for the next maybe 6 months, because we're still working on the other tracks and maybe the levels aren't even complete. So at the beginning of Shovel Knight, we just had Pridemore Keep, which is this like gilded castle environment. And so I just had the music for that level in the game. They had to go to PAX and they had to go to E3 and GDC, all these conventions, and demo the game for people with that music blaring the whole time. And so they were all completely sick of it by the time the game came out. So that's the fun thing, is that whatever songs you make first are sacrificial in a sense, because everyone's going to hate them eventually. They still like them, but if you ask the developers about Pridemore Keep track, they're all going to be like, oh man, I heard that track so many times. So it's like a bittersweet kind of feeling when you get in early with a track. So at that point, the timer is running. I have to start to get more tracks in there so I don't drive myself crazy. And so development tends to go very quickly once you start, because you've broken the seal at that point. You have to relieve them from the monotony of that one track. So I churned out as much as I could, as quickly as I could for Shovel Knight, and we just got it done. And I didn't realize at the time that I was creating a whole style that I'd have to stay in and replicate for years after that. It became my own signature sound. And so what am I going to do in future games? I can't just keep making the soundtrack over and over again. We're going to have to branch out at some point. But how do you branch out without ruining the vibe? You know, how do you change the sound of something without making it unfamiliar and unpleasant to newcomers or to old fans? So I was actually stuck on that for a very long time with Pocket Dungeon. I had severe writer's block because I couldn't figure out how to make it not suck. Everything that I tried was just not, it wasn't working. I mean, I've written soundtracks in like every genre imaginable except Pocket Dungeon Shovel Knight. Like that particular combination of like a puzzle game and over the top fanfares, they seemed fundamentally incompatible in my head. Because, you know, when you're playing a puzzle game like Tetris or something, or Wario's Woods or Yoshi's Cookie, they have interesting music that's catchy, but it's not in your face constantly. And that's, I mean, the music of Shovel Knight is nothing if not in your face. So I wanted something that would be chill and yet also boisterous. And it's, these are complete contradictions. So Sean, the director, solved the problem completely by just saying, bro, do drum and bass like Bomberman. And I was like, brilliant, perfect. I'll get right on it. And I did, and that's the result. At least I'd like to think that he solved the problem and it came out well in the end, but it immediately shattered my writer's block and I got inspired after that. So sometimes just getting the right words from the director or from anybody working on the project can make all the difference. It really, really got me going.
Well, I could think of two words that got me going: locked and looted. Holy cow. I need you to describe what's happening in that. And again, for this to be a puzzle game, and the fact that it is, like you said, it's in your face. I mean, I thought it was, you know, it seems like some of these tracks could be ready for a racing game or some sort of adrenaline rush or something like that. So it fits in to the universe just because you have some great callbacks like Earth Striker and King of the Club and 1,000 puzzle pieces are, you know, related to things you've done in the previous game, but it you know, there's a little more fanfare to it. Some things are a little more peppier. It almost feels like my favorite modern video game, and this is no longer modern, but it's Ridge Racer 4. And so you gave it a Ridge Racer vibe, and it just, it's like, again, it's a puzzle game. How again, I could see the writer's block you were having trying to come up with this stuff. So
if I tell you it was even crazier before the drum and bass shift, that might make sense. It was even more in your face before.
Really?
That was why I was having such problems with it, because it was literally too much. But I couldn't make it subdued. Shovel Knight fans would be like, what is this boring nonsense? Where is all the interesting stuff happening? It's just, this is a bunch of pads and ambient stuff. So I had to find a middle ground. I had to keep it a little bit insane, but not so insane that you're distracted from the game itself, but also not so subdued that you're bored. So yeah, basically that Bomberman kind of Ridge Racer, sort of like Namco-y kind of sound, for lack of a better term. I personally love this stuff. I love like late 90s, early 2000s Dreamcast era vibe. Like all the synths are like cheap sounding compared to the dance production stuff, EDM stuff that you're hearing in modern times. It just sounds like the best ringtone you've ever heard. That's how I describe the MIDI synths of that era. And so it's a very distinctive sound, and putting it over like old jungle beats and drum and bass loops evokes a nostalgia for me that it just reminds me of that era. But I had to tie it in with the Shovel Knight world and give it the motifs and callbacks and, you know, make it recognizably Shovel Knight-ish. I do a fair number of super upbeat drum and bassy tracks in the original Shovel Knight soundtracks, and especially in the DLCs, like be a good one. the new Spectre Knight. Spectre of Torment has a few really upbeat sort of remixes of the existing, you know, Shovel Knight tracks. I'm racking my brain trying to think of the specific ones that I was thinking about. I could hear them, but I can't remember the names. That happens to me all the time. Like, I'll forget what I named something because I knew it as like scary.mid, and it's actually some fancy name in the game. Trivialities. So, yeah, it's a challenge to keep stuff in the same universe, but give it a completely different feel, without losing the spirit of the original.
And I think you have to, because like you said, you've been in this world for years, so you're kind of like the John Williams or the Brian Tyler, people who've done sequel after sequel. And, you know, I imagine that you walk a very fine line between fans want something that is familiar, but they also don't want to be bored or just have the same stuff regurgitated. And as a creative, I imagine you run the same gamut. But then you had, you know, you had remixes, like one of my favorite sort of a 1-2 punch of tracks is A Strange Place and A Familiar Place, which is nice because they're both the same pretty much composition, but one has a little bit bouncier, a little peppier, and one's a little slower. So I guess, you know, giving people that something that feels familiar is important, but I guess what's your take on that?
It's, to me, it's important to give people a sense of space that doesn't go away when they see the space again later. I think the best way to describe that would be if you make, say, a town theme, if you have to make another town theme later that's set in the same town, but after, say, a war has happened or some disaster, it's got to have the same motifs in it. It's got to have recognizable hooks and as much similar harmony as possible, but you need to differentiate it to give it a different emotional impact than it had originally. And it's really hard to revisit stuff from previous games. I'll use the Shantae title themes as an example. I think I've done 5 remixes now, maybe 4 or 5 of, let's use Burning Town, which is one of the more iconic tracks in Shantae games. I've done it a billion times now, and each time it's completely different, but it uses the same melodies and the same chord structure, but it'll be a completely remixed version that has, you know, new drum beats and new synth stuff going on, maybe a new bridge chorus, but it's pretty much the same song. And that's the hardest thing to do, is to not think, I like the previous one better. Like, how am I going to outdo this track next time if I have to remix this? If I put everything into it this time, I made it the best it could be, how's it going to grow in the future? Like, in a business sense, people like to see constant growth year after year. Whereas in a creative endeavor like this, you might have a game in the same universe, in the same series, a couple years later, that's completely different tonally. It's subdued, or it's like calmer, or it's more crazy and more intense. And so you have to adapt the mood that you struck with the original, and betterify it, for lack of a better term. You have to blow it out. And that's not always possible when you blew out the first version in the first place. So sometimes you just have to take it in a different direction that isn't just more intense or more interesting, but like a brand new interpretation that strikes a brand new mood. And it's tough to hit with that and not feel like you were trying too hard or not trying hard enough. So it is a fine line, I'd say.
Well, I mean, yeah, you can imagine that's a reason why you've never heard Freebird Part 2, or you haven't seen a replication of Statue of Liberty, because it's like, once you hit it, you just leave it alone. It's a classic, so...
Bohemian Rhapsody the second.
Well, talk to me about, there's a lot of songs, there's a lot of tracks I love on this Pocket Dungeon. I mean, I'm going to go geeky for a second. Uh-huh. I bought Shovel Knight on Bandcamp a long time ago. And then when I found out that you had this this vinyl, I got it. And I've kept it sealed because I thought, well, I've already got it on Bandcamp. I'll listen to it anytime I want. I can't take this with me. All that said, I've been listening to Pocket Dungeon a lot. And I love these tracks. I love Jumped Up, A Dazzling Phylactery, Omnipresence, and Get in the Bag. What are some of your favorites? And can you give, you know, some backstory about like what means the most because of some creative hurdle, or just, you know, rattle off your favorites.
Let me pull up the track list. Believe it or not, I don't have all these memorized. Like I said, I was renaming them at the last second.
Yeah. In my industry, sometimes when we work on Photoshop files or something, it's like XYZ final.
Yeah.
Goddamn, this is the last one.
Final V2. I'll just name a file just hotdog.txt, and I have no idea what it does, but that was incredibly important. Okay, I like the... I'd say my favorite ones are the boss themes, because they're the ones that are the most, like, hardcore drum and bassy. Locked and Looted, like you mentioned. Jumped Up. I think it's a strong progression of boss themes, going from intense to blow your mind out intense. I'd say anything involving Scrap Knight. So that would be Get in the Bag. Yeah, just like you mentioned. I think I should be able to say this. Let's just say we're about to release another game that also has some nods to Scrap Knight in it. And so I've now written that song twice, but in a very different format the second time. And I like the second version more than the original that's in Pocket Dungeon, but I like themes overall a lot. I'd say that was the first new Shovel Knight night theme that I had done in a number of years. And so it was great to get back into it. I like Pridemore Keep, King of the Club, because I keep trolling Pridemore Keep fans with completely unexpected rearrangements of the song. In Spectre of Torment, there was a version of Pridemore Keep, King Knight's theme, that was in major key instead of minor key. That's pretty much all the changes. It's like, I don't know if you've heard Major Metallica, where they just do all the Metallica songs, but in a major key so that they sound happy. Oh God, you got to check it out. It's hilarious. Okay. But I took a page from that and remade the song in like a happy version, because it's like, oh, this is before all that bad stuff went down. And then, so for Shovel Knight, I completely rearranged. I like took the theme, chopped it up into a billion pieces, and then just scattered them. So it's the song is made of the same melody, but not in the same order. So anyone who's following along is going to be like, wait, no, that's not how, oh gosh, it's going all over the place. I would just like repeat phrases and, you know, put things out of context. So I'd say King Knight's themes are some of my favorite because I get to troll the audience with them every time. And for anyone who really cares about, you know, the veracity or the accuracy of an arrangement, it's like, all the notes are wrong this time. Yes, they are.
I have two follow-ups to that. One is related to my profession. A lot of times when we, not to say we hit a wall creatively or something, but one of the tricks we do is if ever a room layout is not working or a bar, sometimes we'll just mirror it. So it'll be flipped back on itself.
Yeah.
And by virtue of that, like, hey, sometimes there's some merit to that. I can't imagine that you just take a track that you did and flip it and it would be magically working. But, you know, I've spoken to Brian Tyler and Steve Jablonski over the years, and Steve says this one great thing. He says, you know, you've got a tune that works, or you got a theme that works, when you're able to go through the variations and give it a sad, a happy, pensive. And then what Brian Tyler tells me, he says, well, here's taking it a step further. If you think that maybe in a future installment, the hero could become the villain, if that theme can take a darker turn, or like you can rework it. So in a way, maybe breaking it up and putting it together, like you said, maybe that is that's the anti version of the hero or whatever. I don't know. Just crossed my mind. Yep.
Yep. Throughout the Shovel Knight soundtrack, even now, it's still too early for me to spoil things on the original Shovel Knight because some people haven't played it yet. But there are characters who change alignments, let's just say, and their music definitely does carry hints of what they used to be or what they're about to become. Foreshadowing and leitmotif and all those techniques are fundamental, incredibly important to music stuff because people don't think consciously about it, but they're like, why is that familiar? Oh, that works. It's like I knew this guy already before they were a villain. And even if you're not thinking about the conscious reasons why it seems familiar and makes sense, your brain is doing all this pattern matching. And so it's really important to get motifs lined up so that they can shift and change over time, be adapted to new purposes. What they said, 100%. And sometimes you can literally mirror a melody, retrograde it and just reverse what happens, and sometimes it actually does work out decently. I wouldn't say I do that often, but every now and then I'll be like, not exactly out of ideas, I just want to do something out of the ordinary. Let's just screw with this chord progression, let's make it different in some way, and it can be reversed or it could be transposed to different keys. Like, I'll just take it, let's do this whole song again three steps up, and so you just move up the keyboard a little bit and do the same thing. And it sounds completely different because you've reframed the key. And so those can be the basis of an entire chord progression, just little tricks, geometrical things, I would say, for lack of a better term. It's math transformations that are in parallel or not, but doing things to permutate the idea that you have and make a new version that's recognizably the same thing, but totally not the same thing at the same time. Yeah, those are all super effective tactics. When you have to write and deliver like 20 songs, you have to use every idea that you have. You got to just reach for it, you know?
Well, talking about ideas, I might be speculating, but you have three tracks on this album, the Pocket Dungeon album, that are trailer music. And what's suspicious and noteworthy about the trailer music is it doesn't quite align with the rest of the track list. So were those ideas that you tried, were they, you know, maybe like some song starts that you weren't sure they were going to work? Like, why are they different?
They were done throughout the development process, during which time I was experiencing my writer's block and burnout and transitions and everything. This was during COVID times. Like, there was a lot of crazy stuff happening. During that time, I basically restarted the whole sound several times. So what you're hearing is the iterative process of me settling on a soundscape from full orchestra to just chiptune with a little bit of augmentation to the final one that you hear that's more in line with the in-game stuff. It started out just being a chiptune soundtrack. It was just going to be FM, like a Genesis or Mega Drive sounding. And in the end, I went with this more Bomberman-y, Ridge Racer-y kind of feel, but it wasn't always like that. And so the original trailers illustrate progression of sound design, I would say.
That's really cool. Again, going back to my my profession, sometimes we just keep the initial sketches. You know, you have discussions with clients, and we go through so much trace paper and jettisoned ideas. But so it's really nice you capture that, and it still works. It's not like, ooh, this is garbage, I don't want anybody to see this.
Right. I try not to ship anything that I wouldn't be okay with being out in the world. So if it's not at least decent, I'm not gonna sign off on it. I'd rather beg for another day to just polish it up or something like that. there definitely are a lot of parallels between something like architecture or engineering or mechanics or anything like that and the creation, the creative process itself. And that you have to make it structurally sound. It can't just be pretty looking at a facade. You actually have to make the mechanics of it work too. The difference, I guess, is that if a song collapses, it doesn't kill people. So it's Hammurabi's code does not apply to music.
Fair enough.
So the burden of diligence, I'd say, is higher with the hard sciences than it is with the arts, but you still want to respect your audience's time. And so it's very important to make things structurally sound. So I like the comparisons because I think they meld a lot in a lot of ways, the iterative process especially.
Well, why don't we take a quick segue to what you said a second ago, chiptune versus symphonic, which the commonality between Shovel Knight and DuckTales is there are bits of both. But what is really, as a cinema fan, as a film score fan, what really catches my attention is how these things flourish and get bigger. When, you know, growing up in the age with the NES, it was, you know, you were limited to MIDI. So how did you learn how to work with the symphony, or do you have live players, and how do you expand on a couple notes?
It all goes back to Danny Elfman music for A Darkened Theater, and John Williams soundtracks. I had Star Wars and Superman, and Close Encounters, I think I had a tape of. And I just listened to it voraciously, constantly. Every moment that I got, I would be listening to this orchestra and thinking, how can this be so complicated? There's so many people doing so much at once, and they're all in time and in tune. It blew me away consistently when I was a kid. So my parents would take me to the symphony. I was lucky enough to live near the New World Symphony Orchestra in Miami with Michael Tilson Thomas conducting. So, and that was, I mean, one of the great symphonies, in my opinions, of all time. And I would get to go see them a lot and listen to the waves of sound hitting you. And, you know, it's something that's indescribable unless you're actually there. So I was lucky enough to actually be there and see the orchestra doing its thing. As a result, I was dead set on being a film composer when I was in high school. I was like, I want to work with an orchestra all the time and do this as my job. So I read a bunch of books on the topic, history books on film scoring, and read a bunch of theory and a bunch of just, I tried to get myself educated on the topic because there was zero hope of me getting into school for it. My grades were not there. Let's just put it mildly. I was not headed for scholastic achievement. So anything I wanted to learn, I had to do it myself. And that's hard when it's an orchestra because every single instrument has a lifetime of mastery behind it. You know, you could spend your whole life studying the oboe and not understand it fully, let alone all the other instruments in the orchestra. So I had my work cut out. I had to practice and read and listen to other people's stuff. And I was in several online communities of amateur musicians and semi-pro. And I would just get feedback on everything that I did. And people would talk about their best practices, like, oh, you never want to do this. Make sure that you're only, even in MIDI, make sure you're always writing within the ranges of the instruments. Like, you don't want a timpani to be playing a bunch of melodies like a xylophone. It's basically a slow process of acquiring knowledge and do's and don'ts, but it's something that you can do without formal training. You just have to be extremely, extremely diligent about the details, because the last thing anybody wants is to get like laughed out of a recording session because they don't know what they're doing. So I find surrounding myself with experts is generally my best policy. If I'm the least smart person in the room, I'm doing something right. I have a lot of people around who really know their stuff, and I just listen to them and learn instead of just marching in like I own the place. Anytime I'm working with an orchestrator or a score prep person, they contain multitudes. There's so much to learn from any encounter with anyone in the industry, really. So yeah, I guess the short answer to that is I'm always learning, always studying. And so even today, I don't really have what I consider to be a great command of the orchestra, but I'll try my hardest. I have my like template set up, and I have a comfortable way to work on it after many years of seat of the pants, like assembling stuff out of synthesizers and crappy sample libraries back in the day. But as a result of developing that way of working, even my chiptune stuff sounds orchestrated to me anyway. It sounds like I'm trying to be an orchestra within the Nintendo. So I'd say it's like an overall pervasive style that's built up that includes orchestral concepts, even if it's not always explicitly orchestral. If that makes any sense. I don't know.
Oh, it totally does. And I think that is how I'm going to segue this next question. So Jake Kaufman, it sounds like you've got everything literally all worked out. So how did your worst of messes become successes?
I was
heady for the Disney Afternoon audience, isn't it?
Yes, I had to rewrite history.
Very nice, very nice.
No, my big mess was that freaking moon theme. That was my undoing in my head. Like, I almost crashed over that thing because I'm a fan too, and I get angry when people don't do things right. And I'm like, am I the baddie? Am I going to be that guy who ruined a thing that everyone loves? And so every day that I had that assignment, I was thinking, oh God, there's no way I can make this good. Somebody on the internet has done it better, probably 8 or 9 someones, and there's no way I can do this.
And I've heard a lot of them too. So yes, you had your work cut out for you. So
they're really good. People have like done the song to death. And so in the end, I just said, I'm going to make it as me as possible, and while making it fit in with the rest of the soundtrack. It shouldn't stand out in any way other than being the one that everyone knows. It should sound the same as the rest of them, and then I'm doing a good job. Because if it's not terrible and it sounds like it fits in, I think people will like it, and they sort of ignore the fact that there are inconsistencies in it, or you know, that the chorus doesn't hit as hard as they'd hope. They're already hyped up from the rest of the game, so they're like, they're on board for this. And in my experience, it's kind of been how people react to it. They're not too nitpicky about little details in it. But yeah, anytime I have to take somebody else's material and interpret it or even improve it in some way, it feels, I don't know, it feels like I'm imposing on their creativity, inserting myself where I wasn't asked to, even if I literally was and it's my job to. I don't like to fix things as much as build upon them, you know.
Well, you know, if you look at what Hiroshige Tonomura did for the original game, I mean, yes, mm-hmm. That's a pretty high bar. However, with what you said respective to chiptune versus symphony and making the music your own, it wasn't until I listened to what you did with those 5 key tracks that they almost feel like 5 different genres. So I guess, what kind of research did you do when you got the job dissecting, reverse engineering, and were you able to tell that these were 5 different genres in Tonomura's score originally?
Believe it or not, I did 0 research for that because I just played the crap out of it as a kid. So it was in my head already. I've been thinking since I was a kid.
Level. Do you have a favorite level?
It's probably going to be Amazon.
Ah, okay. I'm the Himalayas, but...
Himalayas is great. Himalayas is great. But, it's a hard one because they're all really good and super iconic, and the music is, I mean, it slaps consistently throughout the entire soundtrack. But I've been thinking since I was a kid, I know what this would sound like if I were to make it quote-unquote real. If I were to actually do, like, an acoustic version of this, what would it sound like? I've been going over that in my head since I was young. So getting to do it finally, like, I knew what to do immediately. But still, I was trying to listen to, you know, the ideas of the dev team around me. You know, if anybody had requests or things that they wanted me to really emphasize in the track, I would try to throw those in. The director, Austin, was great at like suggesting like little bits of nostalgia that I could, like, what if you put like a trumpet in here and do this little turnaround here? I always liked that when I was listening to it. And so I'd try to put a little nod into that. But for the most part, yeah, on that project in particular, it was fairly self-directed because it seemed obvious what needed to be done. And then, of course, there's Transylvania, which is like a new area. And I had to make it sound like it came from the original. That was quite a challenge because writing
you gave it a very Skrillex-y vibe at times. And what I liked about this is there was different flourishes that put on it. Again, really intensified the fact that it was different. But also, one thing I never understood or never really realized is that a lot of these tracks were, you know, Hub World is 3 seconds and you turned it mm-hmm. into a minute. And, yeah. and like the themes that were maybe about a minute, you you did the triple, you turn it into 3-minute themes, and because they don't just repeat themselves, they have little solos and flourishes that allow these specific instruments to shine. So I guess, yeah, I'm going to let you open it up to that. Tell me everything. Tell me everything.
So I do this informal competition. Well, I say do, but it was years ago that I was involved in this, called Dwelling of Duels, which is a monthly remix arrangement contest, run by a forum that I used to visit and full of insanely talented musicians. And so that competition was part of what honed my skills trying to compete with these just legendary guitar players. Some of the best OC remix type talent in, you know, in the whole hobbyist scene, as far as I'm concerned. And so I love to troll them mercilessly whenever possible. And so I would do stuff like, did you ever play the game Friday the 13th on NES?
Maybe over a weekend at a sleepover, but it doesn't mean maybe a whole lot to me.
Well, the music, first of all, is about 6 seconds long, the whole thing while you're playing the game. It's just did it repeat. The whole game is just that. And so I made a 30-minute song out of it. The rule was you have to listen to each song at the listening party, so you have to get through it. And so people had to listen to that, and I just repeated it. I didn't even do anything different in the repetitions. I just looped the song for half an hour. And so I kind of wanted to do the same thing with DuckTales, but my genuine artistry got the better of me, and I decided to stop being a troll and made the repetitions different, like added some breadth to it instead of just repeating. But that's my impulse always, is to like make the annoying thing even more annoying. And I have to consciously stop myself from just like doing the most lulzy thing possible. It's hard to make things, I guess it lends actual gravitas to things when you are finally serious after being silly for a while. But I try to keep seriousness to a minimum. So it's more impactful when it comes out. That was one of the times that Hub World theme, I wanted to make it something really pretty that people would just listen to and be like, oh, that hits me right in the feels, instead of, haha, it's so short, there's nothing to it. Yeah, I had fun with that one.
Well, I think you also probably had fun, and again, this is me speculating, the fact you have two Vesuvius themes. You have like the first theme and the second theme, and the second theme is more intense. You take the worst of messes little segment from the original intro, and you use that as a theme in your cue, you know, the worst of messes, and then like you make it, you put some gravity to it. So yeah, what fun Easter eggs. Let's hear that, what you have to share on that note.
Yeah, I love throwing in little references, like you were saying, how themes can be repurposed to be serious or you know, happy or sad, depending on a villain turn, a heel turn, or something like that. It's really important to me to preserve the tonality, the pacing of a motif, of a theme in something, so that you recognize it when it's reused in something else. But I don't always do that. Sometimes I throw things in really subtly so that you'd never recognize, unless you were specifically looking for it, that melody is buried in here, and in the 20 layers there's a counterpoint that's doing the specific melody from the original. And I'd say it's more of a continuum between obvious references and just weaving stuff in as subtly as possible. But yeah, that's a good example of where it was pretty much in the forefront. I think I misspoke earlier and said that Transylvania was a new track, but it was Vesuvius that was the original one. And because of that, I wanted to like tie it into the DuckTales universe. So I threw in a bunch of familiar motifs on it. But I also didn't want to make it an explicit remix of, you know, an existing track. Yeah, I think that's about my take on it, is that it's not always obvious, but when it is, I like to make it as meaningful as possible.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned before about not being able to, you weren't sure if you could beat the moon theme. Well, I think you did, but I'm going to save that praise for a little later, but when you did this, like the closing credit, when you play that in piano, holy crap, talk about tear jerking. It just, you know, you take something that we grew up with and it was childish and, you know, maybe not childish in the way it was portrayed in a video game, but it just came across as chiptune, a little goofy. But when you hear it, you give it such a soul on that piano. So what was it like crafting that and extrapolating it? And did, I guess you played it yourself?
Yeah, it was, it's fan sentimentality. It's basically, this is actually part of us. It's not just a toy that we played with as a kid or some, you know, throwaway entertainment product that we consumed. It's actually part of our identity. As kids who grew up in the age before you could switch to 1,000 different channels and watch whatever you want, whenever you want, you had to schedule your day around watching DuckTales, and it was an event. I mean, you're probably home doing homework or whatever at the time, but it was something we all shared, and it was something that's actually meaningful to us. So that kind of came out a little bit. It was sort of like that particular theme was sort of like a love letter to my former self and all of us who grew up with it. And anyone who's just now coming into the fandom, I wanted them to see, hey, this stuff isn't all silly. It's not all irreverent. There's actually a soul to it, some emotion. That, and I guess it was the culmination of, I mean, a whole game development process. It was sort of my own mental saying goodbye to the project, like a rap party that's more of a rap crying fest, where I'm just like, oh, I don't get to write any more stuff for this. It's over. There's a feeling of loss when you finish a project that has a lot of tracks in it that you're working on for months. It's like, oh, well, I guess I got to break down my setup that I made for this and my whole mental structure of composing for this property is now, I don't have anything more to do with it. So there's a bit of sadness in there too, about the project itself just being finished. It's a finality, I think it is.
Well, I gotta imagine that it's very gratifying to, if you think of Hiroshige Tonomura, when the game came out, there was no such thing as, hey, here's the soundtrack to your NES game. But now that you can get your music on iTunes and, like Shovel Knights on Bandcamp. So the fact that you can share, I mean, I know you spent a lot of work on it and it's great that the fans can appreciate it and literally take it with them, which I think I do. So that means a lot to me. So
I had a cassette tape recorder when I was a kid that I would just like, I'd play Ninja Gaiden and just stand there on the screen and record. And that was my like beats. I'd be walking down the street, just bopping some like super dodgeball. Mm. And now that's so much easier. You can just throw it on your phone and you're good to go.
But yeah, I have to say that the final track for the Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers video game, that the last level's music, that's one I actually tried to record, but found out that my tape player didn't have a record function. So
no, it's read only. Capcom was on fire in the 80s. They had so much good music. It was ridiculous. I mean, they kind of still do. I just played Mega Man 11. It was pretty solid.
Wow.
Like they've always been a very music first company. So all their stuff is very sentimental to me.
Well, your music is sentimental, and I'm going to go even more geeky. there's the idea that, like, why did you, I'm not sure if you saw Brad Bird's Tomorrowland.
Mm-mm-mm.
There's a part in it in the beginning where Hugh Laurie asks the kid, why did you make the jetpack? And he goes, well, I got tired of waiting for somebody to do it for me. So I like the music so much. I made this.
Holy crumo, what the?
So what I did is
through
some completely custom means that will remain nameless, Etsy, I had somebody print this for me. So what I did is I took your album, purchased, of course. But what I did is I didn't just make the tracks and put them on like they are on the album. What I did was I took it I actually took inspiration from somebody who made Super Mario Kart. And they made it like you're playing the game. So you have your title screen, your character select.
You ordered the tracks in there.
Exactly. So now there, you know, there's the Invincible, there's the Game Over, there's the final, there's the boss. So all these little things make you feel like you're playing the game as you listen. So
that's so cool.
I don't know.
The coolest thing I've seen all week.
Are you a vinyl advocate? Because I would love to send you a copy of this.
Wow. Well, I have a very small collection. It's mostly stuff that I worked on that I have a vinyl of, but I have a couple of hand-me-down records as well. I used to have a much bigger collection, but that went away. But yeah, I would proudly display that. That's quite something. I have also on display. I have a lunchbox that they sent over, like an original DuckTales lunchbox with the cartridge in it.
Is that the golden cassette one? I saw that online. I was like, oh man, I missed the boat on that, but holy cow, that's nice.
Yeah, they sent a couple over to the dev team. And so that's like one of my, I don't collect too many things. I don't like have a display case or anything, but that's one of the things that I'm actually proudest of. So that was that's amazing though, that the art that you made for it is awesome.
I was able to clip some of the old things from the NES game and just layer them, but I feel like a schoolgirl. Mr. Kaufman,
DIY stuff like that though.
It just means a lot, you know, and again, I got tired of waiting for somebody to do it. Mr. Kaufman, please, why don't you take us out of this interview? Please tell us where people can find your stuff, what you got next on your plate.
Well, and a move that should surprise nobody given that the world is on fire, I've completely quit all social media. I've swore off it. I'm out of the game. I like used to love making dad jokes all the time for lots of people and staying on top of everything, but I'm basically off the internet now, aside from Bandcamp and YouTube. So you can go to my Bandcamp, vert.bandcamp.com, and go to my YouTube channel, VIRTJK. It's the just VertJK. On YouTube, I mostly post weird joke videos and like little one-off song ideas that I have or automatone stuff. This is my custom automatone here. It doesn't make any sound or I'd show you it. But
why does that look like a bong?
Because it is. It doubles as one. Now I gotta make an automaton bong. I do like musical instrument things, and it's a variety channel, but Bandcamp is where I have my actual soundtracks. That's like the business site. And that's it for me online. As far as next projects, we're about to come out with Shovel Knight Dig, which is a brand new soundtrack full of FM synthesis. Maybe I can send you a track for it if you want to post it.
Oh, please do. Would this be like an exclusive that you're cleared to launch? Or
yeah, I mean, yes. I have a fairly long leash when it comes to like sharing stuff with people, but they would be very happy if I got a track out there. I think.
Please send it my way. Happy to post it.
And then besides that, we're working on Mina the Hollower, which is it is a top-down. Have you seen Mina yet? You should go look for it. We just did a successful Kickstarter for it. And we're developing it in-house at Yacht Club, and it's basically it's our next franchise. And it's, you're a mouse, you're this character, Mina. And it's a top-down sort of Zelda-looking action game where you can tunnel under the ground and jump up and hit people with like a whip.
That's really cool. So
it's super awesome. And it looks like a Game Boy Color game, essentially. And it sounds like an MSX. I'm using the SEC expansion chip on the MSX to sound like Metal Gear 2. Any of those Japanese-only MSX games from back in the day. Snatcher. They all used a special expansion chip. And that's my next project, is to exploit the heck out of that chip. Max it out as much as I can. So, yeah, Mina the Hollower is the next thing I'm working really hard on. So it's mostly Yacht Club stuff that I'm working on right now. I'm not doing any freelance or solo projects, but that lets me put all of my focus into the soundtracks, which is great.
I love the devotion. I love all the things I'm hearing. I'm happy to put all this in the post. But Jake, I've had absolutely so much fun. I've had more fun than watching Disney Afternoon, if that means anything. So love to catch up with you soon. But until that time, everybody, please give Jake your attention, your money, your ears, everything. And we will catch you next time.